and began to tilt it forward, noticing that her hands were beginning to shake.
Oh, silly me. We need a straw. We wouldn't want to spill any of this on you.
Sui let out a sigh. Even in her delirious state, Sui noticed that her eldest daughter always brought along a certain frenetic energy. She was so eager to please, but in a cloying, obsequious way that Sui found so irritating. She had been like this even as a child. Where did she get it from? Felicity found a cluster of straws on the side table and hastily jabbed one into the cup.
Here, that's much better.
As she placed the straw up to her mother's lips, she glanced at the heart monitor and saw the numbers slowly begin to rise. 95, 105, 110. She knew she was agitating her mother, and her hands started shaking again. A few drops of water splashed onto her mother's chin.
Hold still, Sui hissed.
Felicity grasped the cup tightly, suddenly feeling like she was 10 years old again, perched on the ottoman in her mother's bedroom, as one of the Thai maids arranged her hair into an intricate braid. She would shift a little, and her mother would groan in annoyance.
Hold still. Siri is doing very delicate work here, and if you make one false move, you're going to mess it all up. Do you want to be the only girl at Countess Mountbatten's tea party with bad hair? Everyone will be looking at you because you're my daughter.
Do you want to disgrace me by looking unkempt? Felicity could feel the veins in her neck beginning to throb at the memory. Where were her blood pressure pills? She couldn't deal with Mummy like this. She hated even seeing her like this, dressed in a hospital gown with her hair out of place. Mummy must never look unkempt. Now that she was conscious, they must send over some of her own clothes and have Simon set her hair properly. And some jewelry. Where was the jade amulet she always wore against her chest? She stared at the heart monitor anxiously. 112, 115, 120. Oh dear, oh dear. She didn't want to be responsible for causing another heart attack. She needed to leave the room now.
You know, Astrid's been dying to see you,
Felicity blurted out, appalled at her own choice of words. She pulled the cup away from her mother and fled out the door. A few moments later, Astrid entered, the bright light from the doorway silhouetting her and making her glow like an angel. Sui smiled at her. Her favorite granddaughter always looked so calm and collected, no matter the occasion. Today, she was wearing a pale lilac dress with a low-waisted sash and delicate knife pleats all along the skirt. Her long hair was gathered into a loose bun at the nape of her neck, and the delicate locks on the side framed her face like Botticelli's Venus.
Aya, how wonderful you look, Sui said in Cantonese,
the dialect she preferred to use with most of her grandchildren.
Don't you recognize the dress?
It's one of your pohas from the 1920s,
Astrid said, sitting in the chair beside her bed and taking her hand.
Ah, yes, of course. It was my mother's, actually. I thought it was terribly old-fashioned by the time she gave it to me. But it looks perfect on you.
I wish I could have met Great-Grandma.
You would have appreciated her. She was very beautiful. Like you. She always told me that it was unfortunate that I took after my father.
Oh, but Amma, you're so beautiful. Weren't you the leading debutante of your day?
I wasn't ugly, but I didn't come close to my mother in looks. My older brother looked more like her.
Sui sighed for a moment. If only you could have met him.
Great-Uncle Alexander?
I always called him by his Chinese name, Ajit. He was so strikingly handsome and so kind.
You've always said that.
He died much too young.
cholera, wasn't it?
Sui paused for a moment before saying,
Yes, there was an epidemic in Batavia, where father had sent him to manage our businesses. You know, things would have been so different for all of us had he lived.
What do you mean?
He wouldn't have behaved like Alfred for one thing.
Astrid wasn't sure what her grandmother meant, but she didn't wish to upset her by prodding any further.
Great Uncle Alfred is coming home, you know. He's due in on Thursday. Auntie Kat and Auntie Alex are on their way as well.
Why is everyone coming down? Do they think I'm dying?
Oh, no, no. Everyone just wants to see you.
Astrid laughed lightly.
Well, if that's the case, I want to be at home. Please tell Francis that I want to go home today.
I don't think you can go home just yet, Ama. You need to get a bit better first.
Nonsense. Where is Francis now?
Astrid pushed the button beside the bed, and within a few moments, Francis Oon arrived in the room, accompanied by his usual entourage of nurses.
Is everything okay?
He asked, looking a bit flustered. He always got flustered around her. Astrid noticed a spot of chili sauce at the edge of his mouth and tried to ignore it. She addressed him in English.
My grandmother wishes to be discharged.
Professor Oon leaned toward his patient and spoke in Hokkien.
Mrs. Young, we can't allow you to go home just yet. You need to get stronger first.
I feel fine.
Well, we want you to feel even better before we release you.
Astrid cut in.
Professor Oon, I think my grandmother would be so much more comfortable at home. Can't we just have things set up for her at Tyersall Park?
It's not that simple. Step outside with me for a moment, will you?
The doctor said, a little uneasily.
Astrid followed him out of the room, slightly annoyed by the ungracious way he had handled that. Now, of course, her grandmother would know they were discussing her condition.
Professor Oon found himself staring at Astrid. This woman was so blindingly pretty it made him nervous just to be around her. He felt like he could lose control at any moment and say something inappropriate.
Astrid, I must be very, blunt with you. Your grandmother's condition is extremely touch and go at the moment. There's been a tremendous amount of scarring on the heart, and her erection, I mean, her ejection fraction is up to 27%. I know it looks like she's getting better, but you need to know that we are making monumental efforts to keep her alive. All those machines she's hooked up to, she needs them, and she requires non-stop care.
How long does she really have?
Hard to say, but it's a matter of weeks. Her heart muscle is irreparably damaged, and her condition is worsening day by day. She could go at any moment, really.
Astrid let out a long exhale.
Well, it's even more essential that we get her home then. I know my grandmother would not want to spend her last days here. Why can't we simply move all the machines? Let's set up a medical suite just like this one for her at home. We can have you and the rest of her medical team stationed there. Something like that has never been done before. To set up a mobile cardiac intensive care unit in a private home with all the equipment we would need and round-the-clock doctors and nurses, it's a huge undertaking, and it would be extremely cost-prohibitive.
Astrid cocked her head, giving him a subtly eviscerating look that said,
Really? Do we really need to go there?
Professor Oon, I think I can speak for my entire family. The cost is not an issue. Let's just make it happen, shall we?
Okay, I'll get to work on that,
Professor Oon replied, his face flushing red.
Astrid re-entered the royal suite, and Sui smiled at her. All taken care of, Amma. They will move you home as soon as possible. They just have to set up the medical equipment for you first.
Thank you. You are much more efficient than your mother.
Don't let her hear you say that. Anyway, you shouldn't be talking so much. You should rest.
Oh, I feel like I've rested enough. Before I woke up, I had a dream about your grandfather, Aye.
Do you dream about Aye often?
Rarely, but this dream was very strange. Part of it felt so real because it was a memory of something that really happened during the war, when I had been evacuated to Bombay.
But Aye wasn't in Bombay, was he? Didn't you only meet him when you returned to Singapore?
Yes, when I went home.
Sui closed her eyes and was silent for a few moments, and Astrid thought she had drifted back to sleep. Suddenly, she opened her eyes wide.
I need you to help me.
Astrid sat up in her chair.
Yes, of course. What do you want me to do?
There are some things you must do for me at once. Very important things.
Chapter 9. Tyersal Park, Singapore. The lid on the enamel kettle started rattling, and Ah Ling, the head housekeeper, reached for the kettle on the hot plate and poured some boiling water into her tea mug. She relaxed into her armchair and breathed in the earthy, musky scent of the Ying De Hong Cha before taking her first sip. For the past 2 decades, her younger brother had been sending her a parcel of this tea every year from China, wrapped in layers of brown paper and sealed with old-fashioned yellow scotch tape. These tea leaves were grown in the hills above her village, and drinking it remained one of her last connections to the place where she had been born. Like so many girls of her generation, Li Ah Ling left her tiny village on the outskirts of Ying Tak when she was just 16, taking a boat from Canton to an island far away in the Nanyang, the southern seas. She remembered how most of the other girls who were cramped into that stifling little cabin had wept bitterly every night on their voyage, and Ah Ling wondered if she was a bad person to be feeling not sadness, but a sense of excitement. She had always dreamed of seeing the world beyond her village, and she didn't care if it meant leaving her family. She was leaving a difficult home, a father who died when she was 12, and a mother who seemed to have resented her since the day she was born. Now at least she could do something to quell that resentment, in exchange for a modest sum of money that would enable her brother to go to school. She would go abroad, take the vow of celibacy that every black and white ama was asked to, and be tied to serve an unknown family in a strange new land for the rest of her life. In Singapore, she had been brokered to work for a family called the Tays. They were a couple in their late 30s with 2 sons and a daughter living in a mansion more lavish and luxurious than she had ever dreamed was possible. Actually, it was a rather unspectacular bungalow off Serangoon Road, but to Ah Ling's untrained eyes, it might as well have been Buckingham Palace. There were 3 other black and white amas like her in the household, but they had been there for years. Ah Ling was the new girl, and for the next 6 months she was assiduously taught the finer details of the domestic arts, which for her meant learning how to properly clean varnished wood and silver. One day, the most senior maid announced,
"Mrs. Day thinks you're ready. Pack your belongings. We're sending you to the Yangs."
It was only then that Ah Ling realized that her time at the Tay household had been a training ground, and she had passed some sort of unspecified test. Ah Lan, the junior maid who had been there 10 years, said to her,
"You are very lucky. You were born with a pretty face, and you've proven yourself good at polishing silver. So you get to work at the big house now.
But don't let your head get too big over this."
Ah Ling had no idea what she meant. She couldn't imagine a bigger mansion than the one she was already in. She soon found herself in the passenger seat of the Austin Healey, with Mr. Tay at the wheel and Mrs. Tay in the back seat. And she would never forget that drive. They had entered what seemed like a jungle road, and at a clearing, they pulled up to a grand wrought iron gate painted light gray. She thought she was dreaming to suddenly come upon this strange ornate gate in the middle of nowhere. A fierce-looking Indian jaga,
Hindi for watchman. The term is used for any sort of security guard. The jagas at Tyersal Park were, of course, highly trained Gurkhas that could disembowel another man with just two strokes from their daggers.
Wearing a crisp olive uniform and a bright yellow turban, emerged from the sentry house and scrutinized them closely through the car window before ceremoniously waving them through the gates. Then they drove up a long, winding gravel lane that had been cut through the thick trees, giving way to an avenue lined with majestic palm trees, until suddenly the most magnificent building she had ever seen came into sight.
"What is this place?"
she had asked, suddenly becoming afraid.
"This is Tyersal Park, the home of Sir James Young. You will be working here from now on,"
Mrs. Tay informed her.
"Is he the governor of Singapore?"
Ah Ling asked in awe. She never knew a house could be this immense. It was like one of the grand old buildings on the Shanghai waterfront she had once seen on a postcard.
"No, but the Youngs are far more important than the governor."
"What does Mr. Sir James do?"
"He's a doctor."
"I never knew doctors could be so rich."
"He is a wealthy man, but this house actually belongs to his wife, Su Yi."
"A lady owns this house?"
Ah Ling had never heard of such a thing.
"Yes, she grew up here. It was her grandfather's house."
"He was my grandfather too."
Mr. Tay turned to Ah Ling with a smile.
"This is your grandfather's house? Why are you not living here then?"
Ah Ling asked, puzzled.
"Aya, stop asking so many questions,"
Mrs. Tay scolded.
"You will learn more about the family in due course. I'm sure the other servants will fill you in on all the gossip very fast. You will quickly see that it is Su Yi who rules over everything. Just work very hard, and be sure that you never do anything to upset her, and you'll do fine."
Ah Ling had done more than fine. Over the next 63 years, she rose from being one of 12 junior maids to become one of the Young family's most trusted nannies, having helped raise Sui's youngest children, Victoria and Alex, and then in the next generation, Nick. Now she was the head housekeeper, overseeing a staff that at its peak reached 58, but for the past decade had remained at 32. Today, as she sat in her quarters drinking tea and eating a few Jacob's cream crackers smeared with peanut butter and Wilkin and Son's red currant jam, one of the strange Western habits she had picked up from Philip Young, a round smiling face suddenly appeared at her window.
"Ato, my God, I was just sitting here thinking of your grandmother and suddenly you appear,"
Ah Ling gasped.
"Ling Jie, didn't you know I had no choice but to come this afternoon? Her Imperial Highness summoned me,"
Ah Tok reminded her in Cantonese.
"I had forgotten. My head is jumbled with a million things today."
"I can only imagine. Hey, I hate to make your life more difficult, but do you mind?"
Ah Tok held up a metro shopping bag full of clothing.
"These are Mama's dresses."
"Of course, of course,"
Ah Ling said, taking the bag. Ah Tok was a cousin of the Youngs through Su Yi's side. Ah Tok is a great-great-grandson of Shang Zhao Hui, the grandfather of Shang Su Yi. But because he was descended from the second wife of the patriarch's five official wives, none of the children from her branch inherited any substantial fortune from the Shang Empire and were considered lesser, distant cousins, when they were in fact not so distant at all. And Ah Ling had known his mother, Bernice Tay, since she was a girl. She was the daughter of the couple who first took Ah Ling in for training
when she arrived in Singapore. Bernice regularly smuggled some of her finer clothes to be cleaned at Tyersall Park, knowing there was a full team of launderers that washed every piece by hand, air-dried them in the sun, and ironed them with lavender-scented water. There wasn't a finer laundering service on the entire island.
Mama wanted me to show you the samfu. The fastening hook came off. Don't worry, we'll have it sewn back for her. I know this vintage samfu. Sui gave it to her years ago.
Out of another bag, Atok produced a bottle of Chinese rum.
Here, from Mama.
Hiya, tell your mother she shouldn't have bothered.
I still haven't finished the bottle she gave me a year ago. When do I have time to enjoy this? If I had to run this place like you do, I'd be drinking every night,
Atok said with a chuckle. Should we go up now? Arling gestured, getting out of her chair.
Sure. How is Her Imperial Highness today?
Irritable, as always.
Hopefully I can fix that,
Atok replied cheerily. Atok was a frequent presence at Tyersall Park, not because he was a beloved relation, but because of his expertise in catering to the needs of his more privileged cousins. Over the past two decades, Atok had smartly leveraged his family connections and founded 5starlobang.com, an exclusive luxury concierge service that serviced the most spoiled Singaporeans. From procuring that beluga black Bentley Bentayga months before it hits the market, to arranging covert Brazilian butt lifts for bored mistresses. Crossing the quadrangle that separated the servants' wing from the main house, they passed the kitchen garden, which was meticulously planted with rows of fresh herbs and vegetables.
Oh my! Look at those little red chili paddies! I'm sure they must be extra hot!
Atok exclaimed.
Yes, burn your mouth hot. Let's not forget to pluck some for your mother. We also have too much basil right now. It's just gone wild. Do you want some of that too? I'm not sure what Mama would do with that. Isn't it an ang mo herb?
The literal meaning in Hokkien is red hair, but it's a derogatory colloquial term used to describe anything of Western origin, since to many of Singapore's older generation Chinese, all Western people are considered ang mo kao sai, red-haired dog shit.
We use it here for the Thai dishes. The Thais use basil a lot in their cooking. And also sometimes Her Imperial Highness demands fancy ang mo food. She likes this disgusting sauce called pesto. It takes so many of these basil leaves just to make one little batch of pesto sauce. And then she eats one tiny plate of linguine with pesto and the rest gets thrown out.
A young maid walked past them, and switching to Mandarin, Arling ordered.
Lalan, can you pluck a big packet of the chili paddies for Mr. Tay to take home?
Yes, ma'am,
the girl replied shyly before darting off.
Very cute.
She's new? Atok asked.
Yes,
and she's not going to last long. Spends too much time staring into her phone when she knows she's not allowed.
All these young China girls don't have the same work ethic as my generation did,
Arling complained as she led Atok through the kitchen, where half a dozen cooks sat around the enormous wooden work table, deep in concentration as they meticulously folded little bits of pastry.
Shook!
Singlish slang that's equivalent to cool or fantastic or amazing in Malay.
You're making pineapple tarts!
Atok said.
Yes, we always make a huge batch whenever Alfred Shang comes to town.
But didn't I hear that Alfred brought over his own Singaporean chef to England? Some Hainanese hotshot.
Yes, but Alfred still prefers our pineapple tarts. He complains that it's not the same when Marcus tries to make it in England. Something about the flour and water being different.
Crazy rich bastard, Atok thought to himself. Even though he had been coming here for as long as he could remember, he never ceased to be awed by Tyersall Park. He had, of course, been into many homes of the high and mighty, but nothing else came close to this. Even the kitchen was impressive beyond belief, a series of cavernous spaces with vaulted ceilings,
walls covered in beautiful majolica tiles, and rows of shimmering copper pans and perfectly seasoned woks hanging over the gigantic aga stoves. It looked like the kitchen of some historic resort hotel in the south of France. Atok remembered a story his father had told him. Back in the old days before the war, Gong Gong, Cantonese for grandfather, loved entertaining. There used to be parties for 300 people every month at Tyersal Park, and we lesser children weren't allowed to attend. So we used to peer down at the guests from the upstairs balcony in our pajamas. Taking a service staircase to the second floor, they walked down another hallway leading into the east wing. There, Atok found his cousin Victoria Young on the sofa of the study room, adjoining her bedroom, going through stacks of old papers with one of her personal maids. Victoria was the only one of Su Yi's children who still lived at Tyersal Park, and in many ways she was even more imperious than her mother, hence Her Imperial Highness, the nickname Atok and Arling used behind her back. Atok stood in the room for several minutes, seemingly ignored. By now, he should be used to this kind of dismissive treatment, since his entire family had for three generations basically served as glorified help to these cousins. But he, nevertheless, felt a bit insulted.
Lincoln, you're early.
Victoria finally looked up for a moment to acknowledge his presence, calling Atok by his English name as she riffled through a set of blue aerogram letters.
These can be shredded, she said, handing them off to the maid, who immediately fed them into the paper shredder.
Victoria's severe chin-length bobbed hair was looking frizzier and grayer than ever. Atok wondered if she had ever heard of hair conditioner. She was wearing a white lab coat stained with paint marks over a polyester leopard print blouse and what appeared to be white silk pajama pants. If she wasn't born a Young, everyone would think she's an escapee from Woodbridge.
Officially known as the Institute of Mental Health, Singapore's first psychiatric hospital was founded in 1841 on the corner of Bras Basah Road and Bencoolen Street. It was first known as the Insane Hospital, but was renamed the Lunatic Asylum in 1861 when it moved to a site near the old Kandang Kerbau Maternity Hospital. In 1928, a new building was built along Yio Chu Kang Road, and after several more name changes, the new lunatic asylum and the mental hospital among them, it was renamed Woodbridge Hospital in an effort to shake off some of the stigma associated with its previous names. Yet, for generations of Singaporeans, Woodbridge only means one thing. You've gone batshit crazy.
Fed up with waiting, Atok tried to break the silence.
That looks like a ton of paperwork.
Mummy's personal papers. She wants everything destroyed.
Are you sure you should be doing this? Wouldn't some historians be interested in Great Auntie Sui's letters?
Victoria frowned at Atok. Precisely why I'm going through all of them. Some will say for the National Archives or the museums if there's anything relevant. But anything personal, Mummy wants gone before she dies. Atok was taken aback by how matter-of-factly Victoria put it. He tried to change the subject to more pleasant matters.
You be pleased. Everything is on schedule to be delivered. The seafood supplier is sending a big truck tomorrow. They promised me the very best lobsters, jumbo prawns, and Dungeness crabs. They've never gotten such a large private order before.
Good, Victoria nodded. Atok was pleased with the huge kickback he was getting from the seafood supplier, but he still found it hard to believe that the two Thai daughters-in-law of his cousin Catherine Young Akara, Su Yi's second eldest child, subsisted on a diet of shellfish and nothing else.
And I managed to track down that mineral water bottler in Adelboden. Atok said.
So they can have all the water here in time?
Well, it's coming from Switzerland, so it will take about a week. Kat and her family arrive on Thursday. Can't you have it air freighted?
It is being air freighted.
Well, Lincoln, get them to put a rush on it. Or have some courier service do it if those people can't get it here fast enough.
It's going to cost a fortune to have 500 gallons of bottled water flown overnight,
Atok exclaimed. Victoria gave him a look that said, Do I look like I give a damn how much it costs? In moments like these, Atok couldn't believe he was actually related to these people. For the life of him, he could not imagine why the Akaras needed to have special mineral water from some obscure spring in the Bernese Oberlin flown in just for them. Wasn't Singapore tap water, rated one of the best in the world, good enough for these people? Or Perrier, for fuck's sake. Were these delicate Thai royals going to drop dead if they had to drink Perrier?
How are things coming along with the room? Victoria asked.
The team will be here to install everything tomorrow morning. I've also rented 2 mobile home units, which we can park behind the French walled garden. This is where the doctors and nurses can be based, since you don't want them in the house, Atok reported.
It's not that we don't want them in the house, but between Alex and Malcolm coming in from Hong Kong and the Akaras bringing all their maids, there's just no room.
Atok was incredulous. This was the biggest private house in Singapore. He had never been able to count how many bedrooms there actually were, and they couldn't even find space for the dedicated medical team that would be moving in to care for their dying mother.
How many maids is Auntie Kat bringing?
She usually brings 3 of her own, 5 when Duxon joins her, but with all her sons and their wives coming, goodness knows how many of them will show up, Victoria sighed.
The team from Mount E came earlier today to do their assessment, and they think that the best place to set up the cardiac care unit is in the conservatory, he said, trying to reason with his cousin.
Victoria shook her head irritatedly.
No, that won't do. Mummy will want to be upstairs in her own bedroom.
At this point, Arling felt like she had to interject.
But Victoria, the conservatory is perfect. They won't have to transport her upstairs, not to mention all the machines and generators. It's secluded from any noise in the service wing, and they can set up all the machines in the adjoining dining room and have the wiring brought in right through the conservatory doors.
It's no use arguing. Years ago, when I suggested to Mummy that she move her bedroom downstairs so that she didn't have to keep climbing the stairs, she said to me, I will never sleep downstairs. The servants sleep downstairs, and the only members of my family who have ever slept downstairs have done so in their coffins.
Trust me, she will expect everything to be set up in her bedroom. Atok had to resist rolling his eyes. Even from her deathbed, great Auntie Sue E was still trying to control the whole world. And a little gratitude from Her Imperial Highness would have been nice. He had worked nonstop to make all this happen in record time, and Victoria hadn't uttered, thank you, even once. Just then, a maid knocked softly on the open door and peered in.
What is it?
Victoria asked.
I have a message for Arling,
the maid said in a very soft voice.
Well, come in here and tell it to her. Don't just stand there skulking by the door, Victoria scolded.
Sorry, ma'am,
the maid said, glancing at Arling nervously.
The guardhouse called. Mrs. Alexandra Ching and family are arriving.
What do you mean arriving? Arling asked.
They are pulling up to the house now.
Now? But they aren't supposed to be here until Thursday like everyone else, Arling groaned. Oh, for heaven's sake! Did they give us the wrong dates?
Victoria fumed.
Arling looked out the window and saw that it wasn't just Alex and her husband Malcolm getting out of the car. There were 6 cars, and the whole damn family was pouring out of them. Alistair Ching, Cecilia Ching Moncur, and her husband Tony with their son Jake. And who was that stepping out of the car in a white linen suit? Oh, dear God. It couldn't be. She looked at Victoria in a panic and blurted out,
Eddie is here.
Victoria groaned.
Alex didn't say he was coming. Where are we going to put him?
It's not just him. Fiona and the children are here too.
Good God, he's going to kick up a fuss and demand the Pearl Suite again. And that's reserved for Catherine and Duxin when they arrive on Thursday.
Ah Ling shook her head.
Actually, Catherine's lady's maid in Bangkok called me to say that Adam and his wife should have the Pearl Suite. But Adam is their younger son. Why on earth should he get the Pearl Suite?
Apparently, Adam's wife is the daughter of some prince who ranks higher than Duxin, so they must have the Pearl Suite.
Oh, yes. I forgot about all that protocol nonsense.
Well, Ah Ling, it will be your job to deliver the news to Eddie.
Victoria smiled wryly.
Chapter 10 Portofino Elite Estates, Shanghai. Lined up in perfect military precision, on the steps of the monolithic granite and concrete structure, were six attendants. Back in the days when Colette Bing was the mistress of the house, thanks to her indulgent father Jack, the staff had been clad in chic black t-shirts and black jeans from James Purse. But ever since Kitty Pong Tai Bing had taken over the grand residence at the heart of Portofino Elite Estates, she had outfitted the men in black tie butler uniforms and the women in classic black and white French maid outfits. As the convoy of black Audi SUVs pulled up to the house, Kitty, her daughter Giselle, her infant son Harvard, and the children's nannies alighted from the car, and the line of staffers bowed in unison before scurrying around to gather all the luggage.
"Oof, it's good to be home,"
Kitty squealed, kicking off her red aqua zura suede fringe and tassel sandals as she entered the great hall, which was now reduced to a construction site, with scaffolding against the walls, plastic tarp on all the furniture, and exposed wiring hanging from the ceiling. In an effort to remove every last reminder of Colette's taste, Kitty had spent the past year collaborating with Thierry Coutroux, the celebrated interior designer who worked only with billionaires, to redesign every last square inch of the estate.
"Where is my husband?"
Kitty asked Laurent, the estate manager she had poached from some tech mogul's estate in Kona to replace Wolseley, Colette's British butler who had once worked for Princess Michael of Kent at Kensington Palace.
"Mr. Bing is having his daily massage, madame."
Kitty headed over to the spa pavilion and descended the steps to the subterranean swimming pool encircled with carved marble pillars. As she walked down the lacquered cinnabar passageway leading to the treatment rooms, she smiled at the thought of all this coming down too. Colette's hammam-inspired Turkish spa was going to be transformed into a futuristic Egyptian fantasy spa inspired by the movie Stargate. It was her own idea. Kitty entered the treatment room illuminated by scented candles and found Jack lying face down on the massage bed. The scent of frankincense permeated the air as Celine Dion played softly in the background. One of the female therapists, Kitty also had the attractive Eastern European therapist that Colette kept on staff, replaced with middle-aged Chinese women who resembled Madame Mao, was doing reflexology on Jack's feet, while another walked precariously along his spine as if she were on a tightrope, grasping an elaborate lattice of poles affixed to the ceiling in order to ensure the precise amount of body weight on his aching muscles.
"Wow, that's it. That's the spot."
Jack groaned through his face cradle as the woman standing on his back dug the ball of her left foot into a muscle below his shoulder blades.
"Looks like someone's having a good time," Kitty declared.
"Yeah. Yes.
You're home.
I thought I'd find you waiting to welcome me.
When I heard the plane was delayed coming in, I thought I'd get my massage first.
Those stupid French officials delayed our takeoff for 2 hours because of some idiotic bomb scare. They wouldn't even let me onto our plane. So I was stuck in that ghastly terminal with the public."
Kitty pouted as she stretched out on the plush chaise lounge next to Jack. "I'm so sorry you had to be with the public, baby love. Did you have a good time in Paris?"
I sure did. Do you know what happy news I heard while I was there?
Oh, gentle, gentle there. What?
You'll be pleased to know that your daughter is finally getting married, Kitty said, her voice dripping with sarcasm.
Jack let out a slow grunt.
Really?
Yes, and to an Englishman. But of course you already knew.
How would I? Colette hasn't spoken to me in almost 2 years, not since our wedding.
You just don't seem overly surprised.
Why should I be surprised? She was bound to get married at some point.
But to an Englishman?
Well, Carlton Bao stopped talking to her, and Richie Young wouldn't have her, so I think her options in China became quite limited.
What is this fellow's story? He's a nobody. Some non-profit lawyer who's trying to save the planet. I suppose your ex-wife will have to support the both of them forever. Do you know what else I heard? Colette's wedding gown cost $2 million.
That's absurd. Is it made of gold?
Actually, there are gold chips sewn into it, and it's encrusted with precious stones. It's totally outrageous, Kitty said, as she sniffed the glass container of body lotion placed on the side table and began rubbing some on her arms.
Well, I suppose she can do whatever she wants with her money.
But I thought you cut her off completely.
Jack went silent for a minute, then suddenly groaned. Oh!
Why does that hurt so much?
The therapist kneaded a point on his foot with her thumb and forefinger and sternly pronounced,
Sir, this is your gallbladder. It's totally inflamed. I think you must have consumed too much cognac and oily foods last night. Did you have those fried oysters and abalone noodles again when I told you not to?
Ow! Ow! Let go! Let go! Jack screamed.
Jack, answer me. What did you mean by her money?
Kitty pressed on, oblivious to his pain. Jack sighed in relief as the therapist finally released his foot.
Colette receives income from a trust fund. It was part of my divorce settlement with Lighty.
Why is this the first time I'm hearing of it?
Well, I didn't want to bore you with the details of my divorce.
I thought Lighty only got $2 billion.
She did. But as a condition of her walking away and not making any more noise, I had to set up a trust fund for Colette.
Oh, really? And how much is that trust fund worth?
Jack murmured something in a muffled tone.
Speak up, honey. I can't hear you. You said what in U.S. currency?
About $5 billion.
You gave your daughter $5 billion?
Kitty bolted upright on the chaise lounge. I didn't give her $5 billion. She gets the income from a trust worth about $5 billion. It's all tied to shares in my companies anyway, so her income fluctuates every year depending on the dividend yields. And it's only for her lifetime.
And what happens after her lifetime?
It will go to any children she has.
Suddenly, visions of Colette and her future half-white children began flooding into Kitty's mind. She could see Colette in a white summer dress, running barefoot through a field in the English countryside with laughing golden-haired kids. She began to seethe quietly as she calculated the figures in her head. Even if the trust was getting a measly 1% interest on $5 billion, this meant that Colette, who she always presumed was being supported by her poor mother who only had $2 billion, would get at least $50 million in pure income every year. And her unnaturally photogenic children, who wouldn't even know their Chinese grandfather, would also benefit from this.
So where does this leave us?
Kitty said in a grave tone.
What do you mean?
If you've set aside so much money for your darling daughter, who, by the way, won't even speak to you anymore, and her half-breed children that haven't even been born yet, what are you doing for your other children and your poor wife?
I don't understand your question. What do I do for you? I work my balls off for you. and you have a fantastic life and get everything your heart desires. Didn't you just spend $10 million in Paris?
It was only 9.5. I'm a Chanel Privé preferred client, and they gave me a special discount. But say something happens to you. What happens to me?
Kitty demanded. Nothing's going to happen to me. But don't worry, you'll be well taken care of.
What do you mean by well taken care of?
You'll also get a $2 billion trust.
So I'm not worth as much as your daughter,
Kitty thought to herself, feeling her anger boil up.
And how much is Harvard getting?
Harvard is my son. He will get everything else, of course. And let me remind you, that's a great deal more than $5 billion.
And Giselle?
I don't see why I need to leave Giselle anything. She is going to inherit all the Thai billions one day. Kitty stood up from the chaise lounge and walked toward the door.
It is so interesting to know all this. I can see where your true priorities lie now.
What's that supposed to mean?
You're not really thinking of me. Or our children,
Kitty said, her voice shaking with emotion.
Of course I am. No, you're not. You're not thinking of us at all.
Baby love, don't be unreasonable.
Oh, not so hard there.
Jack yelled at the therapist, who had climbed up on the massage table and was now kneading his ass with the full weight of her bare feet.
Sir, you spend too much time sitting. That is why your buttocks hurt so much. I am barely stepping on them,
the woman said in a soothing tone.
I cannot believe you would give your daughter $5 billion just like that. After all she's done to you,
Kitty cried.
Ouch! Oh, Kitty, you're not making any sense.
Colette is my only daughter. Why should it matter if she gets $5 billion when I give you everything you want?
Ow!
Jack moaned.
Stomp harder on his ass and stomp on his saggy balls while you're at it,
Kitty shouted, fleeing the room in tears. Chapter 11. Hong Kong. Chloe had finally fallen asleep after he had rubbed her back for half an hour, and Charlie tiptoed quietly up to his bedroom. He sat leaning against the foot of the bed, facing the floor-to-ceiling window with its panoramic view of Victoria Harbour, and dialed Astrid's private line in Singapore. It rang a few times, and just as Charlie began to think he was calling too late, a sleepy-sounding Astrid picked up.
Sorry. Did I wake you up?
Charlie half-whispered.
No, I was reading. Did you just get home?
I've been in all night, but I was putting out a few fires.
Isabel again?
Charlie sighed. No, nothing to do with her this time. Chloe had been bugging me for weeks to let her watch this movie, and I stupidly allowed her and Delphine to see it tonight. The Fault in Our Stars.
I don't know it.
I thought it was for kids, but trust me, it's not. It's sort of like a modern-day retelling of Love Story.
Oh, no.
Young Love. Tragic ending? You have no idea. When I began to realize where it was headed, I tried turning the movie off, but the girls screamed bloody murder, so I let them keep watching. Chloe's obsessed with the guy in the film, this goofy blonde kid. But then in the end... Oh, God. In the end you had two weeping girls? Sobbing uncontrollably. I think Delphine's traumatized for life.
Charlie Wu, she's 8 years old. What on earth were you thinking?
Astrid scolded. I know. I was lazy. I saw the DVD cover and read the first two lines on the back. It looked harmless.
You might as well have put on a Clockwork Orange for them.
I'm a bad father, Astrid. That's why I need you in my life. The girls need you. They need a good, sensible influence around.
Huh. I don't think my mom would agree with that statement.
They're going to love you, Astrid. I just know it. And they're going to love Cassian, too.
We're going to be the Asian Brady Bunch, minus a few kids.
I can't wait. By the way, I had a really good meeting with Isabel's lawyers yesterday. They don't have any more objections, thank God. You know, in a strange way, the stunt Isabel pulled in Singapore has worked to our advantage. Her lawyers were so afraid that I'd try to get full custody of the girls that they've withdrawn most of their demands and are willing to settle now.
That's the best news I've heard all week,
Astrid said, closing her eyes for a moment. Slowly but surely, she was beginning to see her life with Charlie come into focus. She pictured herself cuddled up next to him on their new bed in their beautiful new house in Shek O, far from the crowds of Hong Kong or Singapore, bathed in moonlight and listening to the waves crashing against the rocks on the cliffs far below. She could picture Chloe and Delphine watching an age-appropriate movie in the media room with their new stepbrother, Cassian, passing a big pint of gelato amongst themselves. Charlie's voice suddenly jarred her out of her daydream. Hey, I'm going to India tomorrow, visiting our new factories in Bangalore, and then I have to attend this charity polo match in Jodhpur that we're sponsoring. Why don't you come for the weekend?
This weekend?
Yeah. We can stay at the Umaid Bawan Palace. Have you ever been there? It's one of the most gorgeous palaces in the world, and the Taj Group now runs it as a very exclusive hotel. Shivraj, the future Maharaja, is a good friend, and I'm sure we'll be treated like royalty, Charlie said.
Sounds tempting, but there's no way I can leave Singapore right now with Amma so sick.
Isn't she feeling a bit better? And didn't you say that a million relatives have descended on Tyersal Park? They're not going to miss you for 2 or 3 days.
It's precisely because so many relatives are in town that they'll need me. It's my duty to help entertain everyone.
Sorry. I realize I'm being extremely selfish. You're a total saint for your family. I just miss you so much.
I miss you too. I can't believe it's been more than a month since we've seen each other. But between my grandmother and everything going on with Isabel and Michael, and our lovely legal teams, don't you think it's better for us to lay low and not to be seen together right now?
Who's going to know we're in India? I'm flying into Mumbai. You can fly straight to Jodhpur, and we'd be totally secluded at the hotel. In fact, if things go according to my plan, we're not going to ever leave our room the entire weekend.
If things go according to your plan? Whatever do you mean, Mr. Gray?
Astrid teased. I'm not going to tell you, but it will involve chocolate mousse, peacock feathers, and a good stopwatch.
I do love a good stopwatch.
Come on. It'll be fun.
Astrid mulled it over. Well, Michael's got Cassian this weekend, and I'm supposed to represent my family at this royal wedding in Malaysia on Friday. I could maybe fly from KL after the big banquet.
I'll have the plane ready and waiting for you.
Kalida, the bride, is a good friend. I know she'll cover for me. I could say I had no choice but to stay all weekend for the festivities. I was roped in,
and I'm at the end of my rope. I need to see you, Charlie pleaded.
You're such a corrupter. Even back when we lived in London during our uni days, you've always made me do bad things.
That's because I've always known deep down you want to be a bad girl. Admit it. You want me to fly you to India, shower you with gemstones, and make love to you all weekend in a palace.
Well, since you put it that way...
Chapter 12, Changi Airport, Singapore. As Nick pushed his luggage cart into the arrival hall of Terminal 3, he saw a familiar face holding up a sign that read, Professor Nicholas Young, ESQ, PhD. Most people at the airport would have figured the guy with the sign, clad in a faded yellow ACS tank top, navy blue Adidas jogging pants, and flip-flops, as some surfer bum hired to be a substitute driver and not the heir to one of Singapore's biggest fortunes.
What are you doing here? Nick said, hugging his best friend Colin Koo.
You haven't been back since 2010. I wasn't going to let you arrive without a proper greeting party, Colin said cheerily. Look at you, tan as ever and rocking that man bun. What does your father think of this look? Colin grinned. He detests it. He says I look like an opium addict. And if this was the 1970s and I arrived at Changi Airport, Lee Kuan Yew would personally come down to immigration, grab me by the ear, drag me to the nearest Indian barber shop, and have me shaved botak.
Malay, for bald-headed. For some reason, the word has also become popular as a nickname for little boys with crew cuts. They took the glass elevators down to level B2, where Colin's car was parked.
What are you driving these days? Is this a Porsche Cayenne? Nick asked as Colin helped him to load his luggage into the back of the SUV. No. This is the new 2016 Macan. It's not actually out yet until March, but they let me have this special test driver. Sweet, Nick said, opening the passenger side door. There was a cashmere wrap on the seat. Oh, just throw that in the back. That's Minty's. She freezes whenever she rides up front. She sends her love, by the way. She's in Bhutan at her mother's resort, doing a meditation retreat. Sounds nice. You didn't want to join her? Nah. You know how my brain works. I'm totally ADHD. Can't meditate for the life of me. My form of meditation these days is Muay Thai boxing, Colin said as he backed out of the parking spot at what felt like 60 miles per hour. Trying not to flinch, Nick asked, So it sounds like Araminta's been feeling better? Getting there, Colin said haltingly. Glad to hear that. I know things have been rough lately. Yeah, you know how it is. Depression comes in waves. And this miscarriage really pulled her under for a while. She's trying to be good to herself, doing all these retreats, and she's cut back on work. She's seeing a really great psychologist now, even though her parents aren't thrilled about that.
Still.
Yeah, Minty's dad made her doctor sign this gigantic stack of NDAs. Even though you know all psychologists are already bound by a confidentiality code. But Peter Lee needed assurance that the doctor would never even admit that Minty is a client of his, or that she would ever need something as shameful as therapy.
Nick shook his head.
It amazes me that there's still such a huge stigma about mental illness here. Stigma implies that something exists, but society is prejudiced against it. Here, everyone's in denial that it even exists. Well, that explains why you're not locked up, Nick deadpanned. Colin punched Nick playfully. It's so great to see you, to be able to say this stuff out loud. Surely there are other people you can talk to. Nobody wants to hear that Colin Koo and Araminta Lee have any kind of problems. We're too rich to have problems. We're the golden couple, right?
You are the golden couple.
And I've seen the pictures to prove it. Colin scoffed, remembering the infamous fashion shoot for Elle Singapore, where he dressed up like James Bond and Araminta was painted in gold from head to toe. Biggest mistake of my life was doing that photo shoot. I'm never going to live that down. You know, I was taking a piss at the bathroom at Paragon the other day when the guy at the Knicks urinal suddenly looked at me and said, Voila! Aren't you the golden god? Nick burst out laughing. So did you give him your number? Fuck you, Colin replied. Strangely enough, guess who's been a good friend to Minty lately?
Kitty Pong.
Kitty? Really? Yes. She was the one who connected Minty to her psychologist. I think it's because Kitty's not a local. She doesn't have the same sort of baggage that we have. And Araminta feels like she can speak frankly with her because she's completely removed from our tight little circle. She didn't go to Raffles, MGS, or SCGS.
Singapore Chinese Girls' School, which we ACS boys used to call sucking cock. Never mind.
And she's not a Churchill Club member. She hangs with their foreign billionaire crowd. It's only fitting. She's Mrs. Jack Bing now. Yeah, I feel a bit sorry for Bernard Tai.
As much of an idiot as he used to be, he did become a good father, from what I hear. But he totally got burned by Kitty. I don't think he ever saw that Jack Bing thing coming.